is be kind to people who you don't know. I mean, putting it another way, who are you most likely to be needing forgiveness from? The person who you got in a conversation with last week at Safeway, or your husband, or your wife, or your parents, or your siblings? There's a reason for that. That is that there's a strange corollary to intimacy, which is that just by the fact that we feel close to someone, that we feel safe with someone, we let down our guard, which means that we show aspects of ourselves, we feel safe to show aspects of ourselves, that we generally hide from public. The parts that, let's say, have maybe a rougher edge to them, a little bit of abrasiveness. It's that part of our personality that we share with those who are closest to us. So it shouldn't surprise us that in today's gospel, Jesus seems to assume that the church is going to need some process of reconciliation. Just assume it. Why? Because he's assuming that you will have that intimacy, that you will have that connection, that you will have that trust. So that means that you will be hurt at times. And Jesus wants you to try to work through that. You know, whenever I think of reconciliation, I remember the story of a woman I heard many years ago by the name of Rose. I was taking a course at the time on faith-based mediation. It was in Fresno. And I had invited Rose to give an example with one of a number of speakers to give an example of what reconciliation had been for them in their life. I'll never forget as she stood up to speak. It was a group about this size. And she just stood there, a slender little woman, probably in her mid-60s. But she had a fire about her energy. And you knew, first of all, that this was a smart woman. But also, you could tell that she was probably a bit of a firebrand. No shrinking violet her. So she started out by saying, yes, I'm here to talk about reconciliation, and I want to tell you a story of something that changed my life. But in order to start out, I need to tell you first about my husband, Al. Al, she said, was a wonderful man, kind, generous, loving, but he didn't demonstrate his love in the usual way. I never got flowers, I never got candy, I never got a Hallmark card from him. But what I did get was handiwork. He would go to me and he would say, what do you want done? And then he would go and do it and work at it around the house. And it was very, very clear to me that he wasn't doing it just because he really wanted to do it himself. He was doing it because this was a statement to me. And that's the way I took it. Each project was his little way of writing me a love letter. And when he was done, that's basically the way I dealt with it. I thanked him and I gave him a big hug. And I could tell that, yes, I had got it. This was his I love you. We had one of the best kept houses in the neighborhood. I said that the story, what I had to tell you about how devastated. But now, with a sort of typical stoicism, just simply held it in and redoubled his efforts on the house. Everything had to be redone. Everything was repainted. Everything was resanded. The floors were redone. He became a whirlwind. And I knew what this was. This, too, was his statement to me. A statement of love and grief, saying, I'm going to miss you, and I worry about you. And it touched me deeply. He did that until he really didn't have the strength to do it anymore. And he was really confined. He had been confined to bed at this time, and the only time he really got out of bed was when I had to drive him for his treatments. And I was coming home from one of those treatments one day, and we pulled in the driveway. I got out of the car, but he didn't. And I looked at him, and he was just staring ahead at the garage door. And I said, come on, Alice, let me help you back in. And he said, no. He said, look at that garage door. It's all scraped. And I looked at him. It was a scrape or two. And I said, Al, let go. He didn't say anything, but I could tell by that line in his mouth, he wasn't going to let it go. Well, let me tell you, the next week, he painted that garage door. He took it all week because he could only do it in short little segments. But he painted that door. He had two coats. And when he was here, he called me out to have a look. And I said, reached over and he took my hand and squeezed it. And I began to cry because I knew what this was. This was his last love note to me. He died 3 weeks later. And in the years that followed, the 5 years that followed that, I became very grateful to that door. Because as I would come home from work, I would see it always as I pulled in the driveway. And I would always stop and look at it and think about it. Sometimes I cried. Sometimes I just sat there and I just smiled, too, just remembering the times that we had together. I was so grateful that he had taken the time to give me this last little connection. So I tell you that story so you could imagine what I must have felt when I pulled into the driveway one day, one ordinary day, and saw that look at the garage door and saw it completely covered with graffiti. It was like a punch in the gut. When I talked to the police who were interviewing me, I could barely even stop from crying. They told me that there was good chances of catching me, and the kid who did this was probably very small. And yet, a couple of days later, a woman showed up with a card from the court and said that they had caught the perpetrator. He had confessed. He was a juvenile. And that because of Fresno's, this was in Fresno, this was Fresno's laws on graffiti. He was facing a very stiff sentence in juvie. But she also said that Fresno was initiating a program of what she called restorative justice, where certain crimes were eligible for an alternative to incarceration. Three conditions had to be met. The person had to have confessed. The person had to be willing to meet with the victim. And the victim had to be willing to meet with the offender. And if those conditions were met, you could try to work out an arrangement that the person would do something that the victim agreed would be an ample compensation for what had been done. And that would be instead of incarceration. And as the woman said, her name was Marianne, as Marianne said, you know, the pattern for being in incarceration is that it becomes chronic. So if he can get maybe his life. So this is a chance for him to have some other life. But it's up to you. Entirely up to you. If you're not comfortable with it, he goes to court. Her first thought was, no. You know, I don't want to have any contact with that book. He took away something special to me. He deprived me of something that is really irreplaceable. No way. But the more she thought about it in the days ahead, the more she thought, you know, I kind of want to have him hear what it meant to me. I'd like to have him. I don't want him to just go there. I want him to know what it did. That this wasn't just some piece of wall. This was my heart that he had touched. So I called him and I called Marianne up and I said, okay, let's have something up. I'd like to meet with him. So we met at McDonald's. I went in, Marianne was there, and I said, where is he? And she said, well, you know, he's on parole, so it's up to him to get here. And I said, what if he doesn't come? And she said, if he doesn't come, it doesn't work. He's out. We said, waited a while, and we're just about ready to give up when Mary Ann turned and said, oh, there he is. I looked at him. He wasn't what I expected. I expected sort of a slender, gaunt kid with this sort of vicious face. This was a big guy, first of all, but a big kind of in a teddy bear way. And he looked just really awkward. Was staring at the floor and he just sort of shuffled over and didn't look at me and sat down. And Marianne introduced us and says, Rose, this is Reuben. Reuben, this is Rose. Now, Rose, would you like to tell your story? So I did. I told him about how. I told him what that meant to me. I told him about my devastation. I told him the loss. I told him what I felt as a physical pain when I first looked at it. And as I told the story, I cried. After I was finished, Marianne turned to Ruby and said, would you like to say something? And he just said, no. I've got to go. Got to leave. He stood up and started backing away. And Marianne said, if you leave, Ruben, that's it for you. I said, I don't care. I've got to get out of here. Got to get away. And he just rushed out the door. Marianne looked at me and said, well, you know, you win a few, you lose a few. What can I say? Thank you for coming. But just at that point, we heard a commotion outside, honking horns and people yelling. And we looked through the windows at the McDonald's, and there was someone standing in the middle of this busy intersection with cars turning, standing right in the middle of the crosswalk against the red light, and cars were turning around him and honking, and people were yelling, and he wasn't even moving. So we went out. And Marianne said, oh, it's Reuben. She stopped traffic, went out to him, and he was standing there in the middle of the traffic, just weeping. She took his shoulder and brought him in. They brought him back into the McDonald's and quieted him down and just and said, and he just kept saying, I'm so sorry. I didn't know. I'm so sorry. And I said, would you like to try to negotiate something now? And he said, yes. So we worked this out. That Reuben would buy the paint, and he would repaint that door back to the condition that it was before. And he was fine with that. He showed up, and oh, was he meticulous. It just took him forever, just a line, just so careful. And you know, took them a couple of days, and I bought them some lemonade, and the second day, I invited them in for some lunch, and I began to talk to him a little bit and ask him about his life, and it turned out that Reuben's father had been illegal and had been deported when he was 10. He had learned a lot of household repair from his father. His father meant a lot to him, and it was devastating when he lost his father. His mother was legal and still stayed here, but she 2 years later, she died. So Reuben was living with a cousin in a house with 10 other kids. And the other thing that she learned was that school had not been a good experience for him. He was big, but he was basically a gentle giant, the kind of person that bullies just targeted on. So he was teased and beaten up, would never fight back. So he had actually left school. He had been truant since he was 15. When Reuben finished the door, Rose came out and looked, and she said, "Well, Reuben, looks like you did it. Thank you. You met your contract." And he said, "No." And she said, "What do you mean?" He said, look down there. I can still see some." And she said, she looked down. She said, "Well, but I don't really see anything." And he said, "No. Well, I must do it again." So he bought more paint and gave a third coat. And when he finished, she came out. She said, "Okay, no, Reuben, you've definitely done it. There's no way that I see anything. So thank you." Then he turned to her and said, "What else do you need, though?" She said, "Well, Reuben, you're done." She said, "I know, but I'm going to do more. Anything else, anything. I can do it. I can do it." She said, "No. Downhill ever since Aldo." And she said, "Well, it's true that the screen door should be replaced, but I can do it." So we went to the hardware store the next day, bought a screen door, and he put it up. And you know, it was the first of a whole series of projects. He came over again and again. Soon he was having dinner with her. And there reached a point when that extra bedroom that they had bought for the children they never had, Reuben moved in. And eventually, he called up Mary Ann, and with Mary Ann's help, was able to do the legal work to take over the guardianship, not Reuben's guardianship. Here Rose paused. She said, "So the fact is, ever since Reuben, my faith has deepened. I have come to see that we have a God of connection, which means another way of saying we have a God of love. That means that we are called to connect. But in order to connect, we have to be willing to reconcile. It's hard work, let me tell you. I can tell you. It's hard work. But the choice is, we have so much at stake. The choice of not connecting is isolation. The choice of not connecting is loneliness. And I know. But the choice of connecting, that." She said, "Well, let me give you an example. I've got it right here. Let me show you some photographs." And she reached into her packet, and she took out one photograph, and she said, "This is Reuben on his graduation day." And she passed it around. And there was this big kid, beaming from ear to ear, and holding the front of him. Rose basically up to about here on him. Just hugging her close to him, like he was going to squeeze her to death. And then she said, "And here's Reuben a few months later, after he joined the army. And here's another picture of Reuben."
in his uniform, standing proud. And then she took out a third and said, "This is my favorite one." This was only taken a few months ago. This was a picture of Reuben with a young woman and two small children and Rose. And she said, "This is my family." And she said, "You know what? I consider it a miracle. Because I never had a child, and now I have a son. I never gave birth, and now I have two grandchildren who come and visit me on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and they're the joy and pride in my life. And every Sunday, we'll take the family over for dinner, and at the end of dinner, he always says the same thing. 'Okay, Rose, what do you need done around the house now?' All I can say is, I am so grateful that we have a God connection. I am so grateful that we have a God of reconciliation. And most of all, I am so grateful."